So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time. Waiting for tonight. Oh. So, take a look.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Ultimate Fighting Championship, Part 2. Once again, there are no rules. There were no weight divisions, no gloves or pads, no time limits, and no scorecards. The rules were simple. Two men enter, one man leaves.
There's no way out. The only way out is to give in. When there's no way out, the only way out is to give in.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. It's John Pollock along with Wei Ting. And Wei, today we are going to be going in a bit of a different direction where we are going to be reviewing UFC 2, which was entitled at the time, No Way Out.
Yeah, how appropriate. The WWF pay-per-view for the longest time in February was No Way Out.
Now, this was a very different UFC at the time, Wei, where the description was, the Ultimate Fighting Championship is the most dangerous martial arts contest in the world. 16 of the planet's toughest experts square off in a locked steel cage and fight in bare-knuckle full-contact combat until one man stands undefeated. It's karate versus jiu-jitsu versus Russian sambo versus kung fu versus taekwondo versus ninjutsu versus pencak salat versus muay thai kickboxing and more. Fractured bones, stitches, contusions, concussions, lacerations, hematomas, hyperextensions, torn ligaments, bruises, and blood. And it's all real. The Ultimate Fighting Championship is the only tournament of its kind on Earth. No gloves, no pads, no judges' scores, no restrictions, rounds, or rules. In this tournament, you don't just fight to win, you fight to survive. Much different from the current presentation of the Ultimate Fighting Championship.
You really have to, you know, I mean, you hear about Toronto and New York banning MMA to this day, and you have to figure that it's marketing like this that's really responsible for the stigma that UFC still has in many places today. You read the back of this VHS box cover and it's just laughable.
Now, for those of you that are not fans, we will hopefully kind of engage you in this. And let's just talk about, first of all, the UFC at this time period. Wait, this was their second event, and it was marketed as brutality. And just, you will watch something, and you are guaranteed violence. And a lot of people are critics of that, but I would ascertain that had they presented the UFC as it is now, back in 1995, they wouldn't have got past show number one.
Oh, yeah.
Their first show did 80,000 buys on pay-per-view. This show did 100,000 buys on pay-per-view, which, to put into context, are more than any TNA pay-per-views have ever done in history.
In fact, the show number one was only supposed to be a one-off, right? It was supposed to be one show. They weren't even supposed to do a second one, but because it was so successful, they decided to do another.
It did very well on pay-per-view, but with the startup costs and everything, they actually didn't make money on the first show. But the second one, it proved that they had something here on pay-per-view, because you look outside of wrestling and boxing, there is nothing that is connected on pay-per-view. I mean, concerts have been a gigantic flop. There's been many other sporting events that have not been able to make that transition over to pay-per-view. So at this point in time, this was a brand new concept from the Semaphore Entertainment Group, headed by Bob Meyerowitz, and Horian Gracie was involved, and it was essentially a tournament that was constructed through Horian Gracie to basically be a giant infomercial for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu and a way to showcase their family and their style of fighting by defeating all these other disciplines. And it was marketed very much in the same way professional wrestling was, of trying to present these different people and giving them almost pro wrestling aspects to them and just selling it as a gigantic, violent spectacle on pay-per-view.
Yeah. So are you arguing that without this aspect of marketing it as a violent sport, UFC would not exist today?
I think that if you didn't have these roots planted, it never would have got out of 1995. much less even maybe 94. Their first event was November of 93. Mm-hmm. And they went through some very, very dark periods of time where a lot of people who got into it were drawn to the spectacle factor of it. And now it's growing into this completely different animal. But I think it took a lot of this to initially get some momentum behind them. And then it's almost two different organizations you're comparing, the 1993 version and then in 2001.
Completely different. Completely different.
It's really the only link is in name value only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get into this right now. UFC 2 No Way Out from, was it Denver, Colorado? This one took place, I believe, Way?
I'm not sure.
We'll say it was Denver, Colorado. It was Denver, Colorado because they made a... They made reference to the altitude level later in the program. And we started it off way with a voiceover describing the night's action, and it was done in almost a Paul Heyman-like delivery by whoever this was.
Well, actually, John, we start with a parental advisory suggested warning label, like you see on the rap CDs. Instead, the whole screen fills up with the parental advisory. That was important, I thought.
So, yes, Wei, you had to have parental guidance when watching this program, and did you take heed of this advice?
Did I ask my parents if I could watch it?
You should have watched this with Mr. and Mrs. Ting.
I don't think so. I actually remember back in the day, whether it be this one or the first UFC, my brother, who's about 12 years older than me, my brother had a friend who would come over to our house and asked to turn these shows on, these illegal UFCs on, because we had the illegal pay-per-view box at home.
Oh, way.
So he would come over, and we would watch this violent, violent, violent sport.
And little did they know that a young Wei Ting would grow up to produce this violent, violent content.
I'm not producing it. I'm.
You are literally putting together the clips that we now watch and salivate over, of men bleeding.
I do it on a smaller level, but it's a much different sport now.
It is.
My parents, for the record, just still hate this stuff. They hate pro wrestling. They can't stand me. They can't stand the violence, even though I explain it's completely core. It's not. They're not really hitting each other, but they still can't stand
it. The best story ever I had of my parents, just when wrestling would be on, and they'd, like, walk in or something. There was a pay-per-view in, like, 2001, and it was when the Hardy Boys were feuding, and it was the December Armageddon pay-per-view. And me and my brother are watching the pay-per-view, and my dad comes in as there's a video package hyping up the Jeff versus Matt Hardy match to come. And my dad just shakes his head. He's like, "That's disgusting. Two brothers fighting." And it's right before Christmas.
That is disgusting.
It was terrible enough that two brothers were fighting, but right before Christmas, nonetheless. So we go in, and they could have
walked in on a lot worse.
Oh, yeah. That's true. We have our play-by-play announcer, and I use that term ever so lightly, Brian Kilmeade. What he brought to this broadcast, Way, I will ask throughout this event.
Yeah.
He was joined by the just as useless Jim Brown and Hollywood stuntman Ben Perry, who was there with his outrageous haircut to provide some semblance of what was happening on the screen for us. Thank God for Ben Perry on this show.
He was the saving grace of this commentary team. And you know what? Let's just get into it. 16 fighters, no rounds, no rules.
That's exactly what I had written down here. They had 16 fighters, but the first round took place. They were dark fights, and then the actual video featured the 8 fighters that had made it past the first round. They said, as usual, there are no rules. Then we went into the ring with our announcer, Herb Perez, who explained this to us. And then they made these little videos for each participant, Way.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in the first bout, was going to...
This is actually the last fight of the first round. So they saved Hoyce Gracie's last first round.
Yeah,
because
they wanted to get Hoyce Gracie out there as many times as possible on this event. While they were running down the competitors, they mentioned that Scott Morris would be competing, and he is a ninja. Scott Morris is a ninja. And did you notice as they were running down the tournament, there was a guy standing behind the announcers not wearing a shirt?
I did not notice that.
This big fat guy standing behind them with no shirt on. I'm like, wow. If ever there was a more apt description or a metaphor for the early days of the UFC. This was it. Big fat guy behind the announcers not wearing a shirt.
Mm-hmm.
That takes us to our first boutway, karate versus grappling. Representing karate was Minoki Ichihara from Japan taking on Royce Gracie. And Wei, as a fellow Asian, do you find the automatic connection between karate and the Japanese offensive?
Not at all. The Japanese invented karate.
Well, as a pro wrestling fan, why were always the Japanese wrestlers given the gimmick of either being karate masters or they threw salt? I was offended and I wasn't even Asian.
Yeah, well, I mean, pro wrestling appeals to very base...
Stereotypes
and base characters. You have either a good guy, clearly good, or a bad guy, clearly bad, or an Asian, clearly Asian.
That's
so
true.
You know what?
I thought you were gonna say, or Asian guy, clearly a bad guy.
I've come to accept it.
It's sad.
Not really.
Royce Gracie comes out with the Gracie train. The whole Gracie family is there to bring him to the octagon.
Yeah. Did you talk about these videos?
I'm going to get into it right now.
Okay.
Where they had these incredibly lame videos where Ichihara is doing every karate pose imaginable, and they state his size is small, but his spirit is big, and he has won over 60 full contact fights in his history.
In his hometown of Tokyo, Japan, Minoki Ichihara is a living legend. A second-degree black belt in Karate-do Taedo-juku, Minoki has won more than 60 full-contact fights in his career. At only 5 foot 7 inches and 178 pounds, he is the smallest competitor in the Ultimate Fighting Championship, but he is not concerned.
Maybe my body may be small, but my spirit is big. I can win.
Minoki says Chinese kung fu movies inspired him as a boy to learn the martial arts.
I like those heroes, and I hope to be strong like them.
If you ask Minoki why he entered the Ultimate Fighting Championship, he'll give you a very direct answer.
I saw Royce Gracie win last year. He looked dangerous. I thought to myself, I would like to fight this dangerous man.
Make no mistake about it. Minoki Ichihara has come to fight.
They've got these, they had the stereotypical Chinese Asian flute music playing underneath, like Yokozuna's theme music. And I was listening to his interview. This guy is actually speaking English. He's actually trying to speak English, but they choose to dub him over anyway.
Well, of course.
Yeah, they choose to dub him over anyway, and you could tell he was mouthing the exact same words.
I thought the translator was awesome. He was so calm in... I have come to win this contest.
Well, that's how we all talk.
Yes, you are all calm, play flutes, and practice karate.
Well, I walk out to flute music. I drive to flute
That's
music.
How you enter the office every morning.
Yeah.
This was the first event that Big John McCarthy ever officiated for the UFC. He was not an official for UFC 1, but...
What is his background? I know you guys are friends. You've had him on the radio show a lot of times. Like, what, he was a cop before this?
He was a law enforcement official, yeah. And his father actually founded the task force, I think it was. And mm-hmm. So he was involved as a law enforcement official. I think even at this point in time, he since that time opened up his own Big John's Ultimate Mixed Martial Arts Academy, I think it's mm-hmm. called.
But did he
have California?
He obviously had some martial arts training.
Yeah, like this. He is a black belt under the one of the Gracies.
Okay.
And he trained himself, and originally he wanted to fight in the UFC, and they wanted him to be an official.
So he already had a jiu-jitsu black belt prior to this.
I don't know if he had his black belt by this time, but it definitely been training.
Huh.
So
it's interesting. Okay.
So this was his first bout that was televised that he had officiated. He officiated every fight on this card, which is actually that's incredible in a 16-man tournament. They go to Royce Gracie's video, and wow, is this charismatic. Hello, I'm Royce Gracie. And what I enjoyed the most about the entrances was the announcer, Rich the G-Man Goines, who did like the Ken Kennedy gimmick where he repeated their last name.
Yeah.
He'd be like, Royce Gracie! Gracie!
What's the background on that? Why do the announcers used to do that?
I have no clue. I always thought that maybe it was just a tribute to the old school announcers who would do it with the old systems where there would be that echo.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, but I don't know why you would honor them in that fashion. Like, yeah. One of the malfunctions of the audio equipment of the time we will bring into today's vastly more technological equipment.
Next, we're going to bring back hiss.
Hoist Gracies. Maybe we'll mispronounce names as well. I can't believe no one on this broadcast, especially Brian Kilmeade, didn't refer to him as Royce at all during this show.
Yeah, well,
because that still gets done today.
Their brother was organizing the whole event, right? So they must have clued them in before.
So the first round, this was interesting to watch, Wei, because we are much more, I guess, educated to fights now and what to expect in a fight. There was zero defense at this point in time. An instant takedown by Gracie, and he basically could have been asleep during this fight and achieved mount position, mm-hmm. getting on top of Ichihara. The best part of this was Hicks and Gracie in the corner giving pointers to Hoist, and a fan from the front row leaned in to tell Hickson some notes.
Is that true?
Yeah, it happened. It was right on the tape.
Wow.
It was just some fan who leaned in. They have a term in mixed martial arts called lay and pray, which is what we saw here, where a guy just gets on top of him. And
no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, Hoist was...
He was trying to deliver punches to the ribs and basically transitioned into an arm bar. And before it was even locked in, Ichihara tapped out. I don't think he wanted any part of a full pressure arm bar.
Yeah, before his arm was even straightened. Ichihara starts tapping. And I think at this point, so little was known about jiu-jitsu that there was so much mystique behind these arm bars that I think the feeling was that once you're in there, your arm is done. You're going to die. So you know what? Better to tap before the possibility even arises.
Now, for current fans, you're used to hearing the words, "And it is all over," when a fight ends by Mike Goldberg. But here the call was...
He tapped.
Was that an arm lock?
Yes. No. I think he choked him out. I couldn't tell.
Oh, he did. Yeah. Arm lock.
It looked like an arm lock.
He probably broke his arm.
By Kilmeade.
This is an excellent
Jim
excellent
Brown
call.
Didn't say a word during this fight.
He didn't say a word throughout the whole event.
He was just there to do media for the event.
He's
and
wrong.
He just sat there.
This was the
Ben Perry show. Because he was the one explaining what a mount was, what jiu-jitsu is, what an arm bar is. Kilmeade had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No idea what was happening.
Yeah, the final call for this fight was so funny because Hoist Gracie gets Ichihara in the arm bar, and the commentators are like, was it an arm lock? I thought it was a chokeout. It looked like a chokeout to me.
Those are often confused.
He's choked out.
Then we go to a video where they give us a brief little synopsis on each discipline represented tonight. There was karate, where they said, means one blow, one kill. Kickboxing, they don't dance, they just get the job done. Kung fu, which they described as the movements of five animals, including the snake, the praying mantis, the tiger, and the crane. And I missed the other animal. Then there was grappling, which was done to like this rock, like techno music.
And then exotics.
Where they say that the result of grappling is the winner is crippled and the loser dies. Not great options. And then they had the much forgotten discipline of exotics, which was everything else.
Yeah.
And they basically just had like a Jet Li style of showmanship here, where a guy actually applied an STFU onto someone.
Really?
The John Cena move. The STF was actually used. That's Masahiro Chono was an exotics practitioner.
Yeah.
Sounds like a stripper.
Next, it was fun. I liked the video package. It was educational.
They were so cheesy.
And fun, yeah.
Next up, we had Scott Morris, who was representing the exotics.
The exotics, the ninja, Scott Morris.
Yes, the ninja.
Hi, I'm Scott Morris, representing Robert Bussey's Warrior International in the Ultimate Fighting Championship, and we came to win.
He was taking on Patrick Smith, who represented kickboxing, and he was part of the first UFC event where he lost to Ken Shamrock.
My name is Patrick Smith, ranked fifth in the world by WKC. Just won the 1993 Heavyweight Tsubaki Challenge. That's why I think I'm going to win this competition.
They build Smith as having over 200 victories, and he is from Denver, Colorado. Morris came out in sweatpants and a cut-off sleeve shirt. He looked 1985 ready to fight. And Morris runs in, and Smith, almost at will, just landed right on top of him. Like, Smith basically worked his own takedown. And there was ground and pound from Smith, and then brutal blows to the top of the head.
Seven elbows to the top of the head.
To the top of the head. I counted 20 unanswered blows.
Wow.
In total here. And Patrick Smith, thankfully, won this fight after Scott Morris' corner threw in the towel. Now, I was watching this, and I was...
He was pretty unconscious, man.
This was terrible, and I looked this up, and apparently during this event, John McCarthy was not given the power to stop fights.
What?
And that's why...
What does that mean?
He could not stop a fight.
So how would a fight end?
You had to throw the towel in.
Oh.
Or verbally submit. But John McCarthy, if a guy... So later in this, like, there was another instance in this where I was like, how could he not stop this?
Yeah.
And McCarthy demanded after this event that he be given that power to stop fights because he said he wouldn't continue. And that led to the changes. But during this event, he did not have the power to stop a fight, which is criminal. This was a brutal, brutal time period.
It was disgusting watching this, but a lot of fun.
Smith was interviewed after the fight, and this was awesome, where he said... Yeah, I've worked on my ground game a bit. Not like I should. Yeah, because you're going to run into Hoyce Gracie later. Not that you should. And then the announcers, they're always good to give us updates on the fighters. They alerted us that Morris can't even stand up right now. Great. So let's go to our next bout. It is Johnny Rhodes, no relation to Dusty or Dustin, taking on Fred Edish, who, if any of you thought appeared in Napoleon Dynamite as the older brother, it's actually a different person. Fred Edish was an alternate and representing karate. This was awesome. Fred Edish.
Fred Edish has become a legend in the mixed martial arts community for this lone appearance in the UFC. I mean, if you want to know about Fred Edish, simply YouTube Fred Edish, fetal fighter, F-E-T-A-L, as in fetus, as in the fetal position. He is credited for pioneering the style known as fetal fighting in this match. From the moment he appears with the mustache, you can tell that this is going to be a classic fight.
Edish immediately got onto his back, and unlike Antonio Inoki, he was not delivering any leg kicks to Muhammad Ali.
He simply had his hand up there in a chop position. His lone defense.
Oh yeah, he could. The great Khali chop could his lone defense stop Johnny Rhodes.
Was the blade of his hand.
He then covered his head while he was on his back. They then announced, one of the commentators, if he knew the choke, he'd go for the choke. This in reference to Rhodes when he got onto the ground. Jim Brown spoke, and he said, it's amazing they don't learn the choke.
Rhodes just pummels the shit out of Edish. And then for some reason he decides to back off. Edish regains composure and gets... The arm, the chopping hand back up there while his face is all bloodied and wow.
I loved it how they broke Rhodes' balls over not knowing how to choke, and then he won the fight with a one-arm choke.
Hmm.
So Johnny Rhodes advances. Fred Edish goes into legendary status after this fight. The post-fight with Rhodes was awesome because he's talking to the commentators. Fred Edish walks up from behind him, all bloody, and he looks like he's just out of a nightmare. And he goes, and he clearly just wants to shake hands or hug him. He thinks Rhodes is going to turn, and Rhodes just walks away. And Edish is left there looking like an idiot, and they just cut away. That was wicked. Next up in our quarterfinal bout, it's Remco Pardo.
Hello, I'm Remco Pardo from Holland. I'm Dutch Open, Open Belgium, Open German, Open Danish, and World Champion in Jiu-Jitsu. I'm competing in this event to get the first prize.
Taking on Orlando Waite, and Pardo had a...
Waite.
Waite?
Yeah.
Orlando Waite, the kickboxer, who is giving up 110 pounds here to Remco Pardo. And I gave Waite the Scott Putski Award. This man was shredded for this bout. Not that they were doing any testing of the sort, so it was probably actually encouraged in their gift bag. There was an unintelligent promo from Pardo in his video. I didn't know what he said.
Pardola,
did you notice who was in his corner? It looked like it was Haystacks Calhoun who he had. This
really?
Man must have been 500 pounds and a lumberjack.
Pardola gets a takedown immediately, and then he just unloads elbows to the head of his opponent on the ground.
Yeah, and downward elbows to knock out Vate.
Yeah.
And the towel is thrown in as Vate's legs go limp.
Yeah,
that
it was
a little
disgusting.
Scary.
Basically, the position was... the kickboxer was on the ground, and then Remco was kind of laying on him like he would lay on a couch. You know what I mean? With his back against the side of his opponent, leaving his the kickboxer's head completely unprotected from the elbows. And so Remco would just basically back his elbow into his opponent's head.
Horrible.
And after about seven of these, he realized, the guy I'm beating up is already knocked out.
He is not
maybe
moving.
Maybe I should stop. And then he stopped himself.
After the fight, in the interview, in the utmost confidence, Pardo stated, "I didn't expect to win."
Yeah.
But he's moving on.
And they ask him, "What are you going to try to do the next round?" And he says, "Try to win."
I didn't expect to win.
You didn't expect to win?
I thought he was a tough guy.
Okay, he was a tough guy, but maybe you were a tougher guy. What do you anticipate for your next match?
Try to win.
You were really getting some all access here behind the scenes. Next up, Jason DeLucia takes on Royce Gracie in the quarterfinal bout. They announce, or the idiot Kilmeade announces, "Gracie can put you to sleep faster than your grandmother can say once upon a time." Funny. The G-Man announces that Royce is the defending Ultimate Fighting champion.
Yeah, he said that a number of times.
Maybe that's where Jack Swagger got it from.
Champion. Okay.
The All-American.
Yeah.
The Ultimate Fighting champion.
Mm-hmm.
This was the infamous fight where Perry announced that DeLucia was in Hoyce's guard, and Kilmeade asked, "What's that?" And they had to explain what the guard position was.
Yeah, nobody knew. Nobody knew. Yeah.
What's the best description of the guard, Way?
The missionary position.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Where you are basically the opponent is on his back and has his legs around your hips, and your legs can be either apart for an open guard or crossed for a closed guard, and it's
mission control.
And there's actually a big debate going on right now, Way, where John Fitch, I believe it was, recently came out stating that the guard is it's not an effective position anymore, and that it doesn't have the control it once did because of the level of fighters advancing.
Yes.
But this was 1993, where the guard might as well have been a shotgun.
Yeah, that's so true. Absolutely true.
In this fight, I didn't know much. It was a sick ending.
Yeah, DeLucia falls in Gracie's guard. Gracie sweeps and ends up mounting DeLucia.
Well, it was DeLucia who actually was sweeping Gracie, and Gracie didn't really even care that he was giving up position here because he then secured the armbar, and it was a sick-looking armbar.
Yes.
And again, this was just criminal because he tapped maybe 10 times, and I think you had to wait till the towel was thrown in.
What?
I don't understand.
That makes no sense. I think, well, you gotta remember,
at this point, were taps even instituted?
I think they must have been, because...
I don't know if John was just slow to finish, to separate them with the tap, because DeLucia must have tapped 10 times.
Yeah, he tapped a lot.
And that was just painful, because his arm was going to snap.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, wouldn't big John McCarthy be embarrassed to watch these fights?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It was not the highest level of safety at the time.
Yeah.
No real breaks here. We go right into the semifinals, and it's Pat Smith against Johnny Rhodes. And there's a video on...
Karate versus kickboxing.
Yes, and they interview Smith, and they mentioned that he lost to a shoot fighter in Ken Shamrock at UFC 1. And I'm curious, aren't all of them shoot fighters?
I suppose so. But I don't know. Is there a specific trait of a shoot fighter?
We'll have to look that up.
Okay.
But that was the video. I enjoyed how Rich Goines, the G-Man, he was keyed as ring announcer.
Well, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, what's he doing in the middle of the ring introduce him. Both with the microphone. Men.
Yeah, what is
this?
It
is weird. What's his role?
Yeah, Patrick Smith said he didn't prepare for ground techniques in UFC 1, but now he knows how to get out of ankle locks. Now he knows ground fighting.
Excellent. Well, this fight did not require those skills learned, because it was a full stand-up fight, and Rhodes basically walked into a standing guillotine by Smith, and 45 seconds this fight was over as Rhodes tapped out with his foot.
Taps out with his foot.
Did you notice that?
Yeah,
I
did.
They went back. They even mentioned in commentary that, well, you tap out with whatever you have, and he tapped out with his foot.
He taps out with his foot. I've never seen that before, but no. I guess why not?
First for everything, Wei. And should. Pat Smith is going to the finals.
Yeah, like I said before, I mean, so little was known about these submission techniques that the coroner and the fighters, they were so eager to tap out. I mean, they are very dangerous, but I mean, at least in the UFC today, fighters would wait a little bit. It seems like a lot of times these submissions in the UFC.
No, I don't think anyone knew submission defense. They're like, they got me, I'm fucked.
Yeah, then they just give up.
Did you enjoy? This was Pat Smith was now 2 for 2 on post fight interviews. The guy asked him why his fights have ended so quickly, and he responded, "Easy opponents, prick."
Now he thinks he's the shit. Now he thinks he's the king of submission.
Sadly, this guy still fights. That's
Yeah, he fought on that Yama MMA
Yama
show.
Yama pit fighting, and he does a lot of small shows.
Yeah.
Next up, we have Remco Pardoe against Royce Gracie in the other semifinal. Grappling versus grappling, Wei. This was going to be a clinic. And
these guys fought just like 10 minutes ago. I thought it was
Yeah, I know.
Quite
they
quite
had
amazing.
No downtime here.
Yeah.
What do I have written here? Take us through this one, Wei.
Well, Hoyce was outweighed by Remco by nearly 90 pounds here. No weight classes, of course, in the UFC back then. Hoyce takes Remco down after struggling a little. With a waist lock. And then Hoyce takes Remco's back and then begins to choke him out using Remco's own gi. And finally, after a while, Remco taps out. Simple as that. Hoyce Gracie advances.
I've always hated that technique.
I've
trained with gis, and I've always hated that choking a guy out with his own gi. To me, it's a dirty tactic. It's like you're using
the mindset
behind training with a gi is that if you were to get into a fight with someone on the street, you want to resemble clothing on them if they have a collar. But I mean, today's UFC at least is a professional fighting event where you're not allowed to wear gis, and I'm actually a fan of that, because I find using the gi, if you don't necessarily train with a gi, then you're at a bit of a disadvantage, and I just find choking a guy out with his collar like that, it just seems that it's you're using an outside force.
But the gi
is... It would be like me using my shoelace on my wrestling boot to choke you out.
That'd be a bit different.
How is it different?
Because that's a lot more sissy.
Than taking a guy's collar.
It's a collar.
Choke him out with your arm.
Yeah, but you're only using a collar. You're not taking the belt from the gi and wrapping it around your head.
You're using a something beyond.
You're using it as
your body.
You're using
a man.
You're using it as an extension of your arm. I mean, a gi can also be.
There's a certain technique to being able to get the gi around the throat, but
yeah,
just tugging on a.
That's the whole technique. That's the technique. What other technique is there?
Well,
a gi is also advantageous to you in the sense that it creates friction for a grappler. Now, are you saying that should be illegal as well? That's not a worthwhile.
I'm not a fan of the where one guy wears it like a Hidehiko Yoshida fight where he'll wear the gi.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that.
Gi on gi, fine.
Yeah.
But I'm not a big fan of the gis to begin with. Even training, I always found I was much better without a gi than with, and they always insist I had to wear a gi.
But in the context of a UFC 2, where all things are legal.
Sure. In this context, it was probably the most tame thing we saw on this show. So, Royce Gracie gets the victory. Jim Brown, with some great analysis after the fight, he said, "What a fighter." And,
he really beat him.
Afterwards, you could tell Brian Kilmeade was just jumping. He was hoping that there was going to be some post-fight, because after, Royce Gracie said something to Remco Pardoe, and he got so excited, and he's like, Oh, there it worked. Oh, he said, come back. Come back to the UFC. Awesome. So we have Hoist Gracie against Pat Smith. During this time, they interviewed Ken Shamrock, who was wearing a gold chain, and boy, did he resemble 1994 style in this interview. He had a broken hand at this point, and that's why he wasn't in UFC 2. And he said he wants Hoist to win because he wants a rematch with him. And the announcers then talk about the whole sport. This was amazing, where they say it takes 4 months to be a force in the UFC. And then Kilmeade, it's easy. It's easy to learn. Really. And with that, we go to the finals, where $60,000 goes to the winner, and I guess nothing to the loser.
Nothing.
Hoist Gracie against Pat Smith, kickboxing versus grappling. And they announced that Smith has done a lot of work on the ground. I just think back to Smith's promo where he says, I've done work on the ground. Not like you'll need it here in the finals against Hoist Gracie. They did an interview with Hoist Gracie, a pre-packaged interview where there was a big jump cut during it. And then during the fight, we saw Hoist stop a judo throw, and he lands on top position, and he just starts delivering punches, and boom, like you were saying, Wei, towel thrown in right away. I thought a little early if I was in Smith's corner.
He wasn't even in a submission.
No, it was just, he wasn't even really eating too many shots. If he were going through, but Hoist Gracie is not exactly the most feared striker.
No, Hoist Gracie was just delivering a few punches through, and then corner throws the towel in, but Pat Smith had no disagreement at all. He was fearful himself, it seemed, and he just congratulated Hoist on his victory, and there you go, Hoist Gracie champion, ultimate fighting champion once again.
For the second time. This one finishing a minute 13, and they announced that a minute 13, that's the second longest fight for Hoist this evening.
Yeah.
These fights were short, dude. This whole event was over 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Which I was a big fan of.
Me too. There were no fights that went past 5 minutes, and this was
There was one dark fight fun that they mentioned with Johnny Rhodes that went 16 minutes.
Really?
But after the fight, Herb Perez called Hoist Gracie the ultimate warrior.
Yeah.
And said that last time he's going to Disneyland, this time he's going skiing. And then he was trying to talk to Hoist, who had no understanding of the English language, and just smiled and nodded like most foreign fighters do when they don't know what is being asked.
Yeah.
So that is UFC 2 Wei. I'll give this event a 5 out of 10 for pure cheese value. Very little skill involved here, but still, it was a brand new endeavor at the time, and it was very tough to prepare because it's not like today where you have 17 years of history behind it.
Mm-hmm. I'll give this a 7.5 out of 10. I found it thoroughly entertaining, especially what we know now about the UFC, and it's just a fun little comparison and to see how violent and barbaric and what else does it say on the box?
I don't know how well our listeners are going to take to a UFC review, but I would encourage you guys, if you can, by no means go out and buy this event, but find it online. And maybe as we said, it's 90 minutes, and it's something curious to go back and watch and see the parallels. Because believe me, the WWF and WCW were very, very aware of the time of UFC and how well they were doing on pay-per-view. And I think there's a lot more links than at face value between the two promotions. I mean, to this day, they compete over fans. I think you'll see on March 27th when it's UFC 111 the night before WrestleMania. It's going to be a lot of crossover, and I think it's because they do appeal to both fans of what they enjoy about pro wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day here, I mean, this was very much, Bob Meyerowitz was a giant wrestling fan and modeled it after that, and a lot of officials in the UFC are pro wrestling fans, and they look at that model, so don't be one to just kind of dismiss mixed martial arts. And conversely, if you're a mixed martial arts fan, kind of dismissing pro wrestling without kind of doing, don't just look at kind of the headlines or just, a few instances from either sport to kind of dismiss the entire industry. I think a lot can be learned from both.
Yeah, I was once only a fan of pro wrestling, but ever since The Ultimate Fighter, I've been hooked on MMA. I mean, MMA for me, and you know this, John, I've mentioned this many times, it's really filled the void of realism that I was missing from pro wrestling.
I would say, like, Wei, we watch, on the Fight Network, we have the St. Louis Wrestling at the Chase, and I would argue that that product is much closer to the UFC of today mm-hmm. than the WWE or TNA.
You and I, we can talk about this now. You and I were in Calgary this past week. We were working on a documentary to preview Bret Hart's return to WrestleMania.
WrestleMania for the Fight Network. And we had a chance to speak to Bret himself this past weekend, as well as various Hart brothers. And we actually went out with a couple of the Hart brothers, Keith, Bruce, and Ross, who were, who of course you may know, were involved with Stampede Wrestling, of course. And we had this exact same discussion. Stampede Wrestling was known for creating a very realistic style of pro wrestling, and the comparisons were made throughout the evening that the UFC right now is arguably what Stampede Wrestling was back then, at least in terms of the fighters' reputations and things like that. Bret himself makes that comparison.
What I love too is today with UFC fighters, more and more now, I think they're really starting to understand the business of selling fights and playing personalities. I think no one bigger than Frank Mir right now, who, I mean, he had the whole controversy this past week where he said he wants to kill Brock Lesnar and he'll be the first death in the octagon.
Yeah.
And, you know, fans are just up in arms that, like, how can that guy say that? What, I want to see him get beat. And it's like, that's the mentality wrestling fans used to have for, you know, old school heels who...
You're marks. Like, you're marks.
Just because guys are going out there and cutting promos on their opponents doesn't mean that that's... They're just turning their own personality up. And what does that sound like to you? I mean, mixed martial artists are learning from pro wrestling heels of the past where you would pay to go see Frank Mir get choked out or get defeated. And I think it's that believability that people have. I really believe that the real versus fake argument is not much of one. I think people are going to watch a compelling product, and it's not... You look at 1997, 1998... when wrestling was destroying mixed martial arts, and there wasn't that argument about real versus fake. The fake stuff was doing much better business, so I don't think it really comes down to that. You present a good product, people will get behind it.
I could care less what's real or fake as long as I'm entertained. And with the UFC, with the promos and all that, it's a fine line because UFC presents itself as a real sport, which it is, and... once you get too much into the pro wrestling, like say Jerome McGinley, for instance, he wouldn't be cutting promos like this. He wouldn't be trash talking. But why then in the UFC would it be more acceptable for a fighter to talk that way?
Well, first of all, when it comes to, you know, like NFL athletes, NHL athletes, you have to realize they are within an organization that is at, you know, a higher prestige level than even the UFC is right now. I mean, there is no problems with the NFL in terms of, well, getting to pay-per-view. I mean, they are in solid financial standing, nor are they trying to get people to purchase. There's a built-in audience for that, but I think when you are selling fights, when you are selling conflict, you need to have those personalities that are going to get a guy to, you know, want to spend $50, because at the end of the day, you're selling a conflict of where there's this guy and there's this guy, and I want to see who's going to win that fight.
Yeah.
And I think you're much more in the UFC, in the WWE, in TNA, you're selling personalities more so than you're selling a sport. Mm-hmm. I think with football, with hockey, with baseball, there's that built-in audience. They are in solid standing, I think, within the sports environment, that you're not necessarily selling an individual. You are selling the game to a large part. And I think with the UFC, I mean, yes, it happens to be a combat sport, and I think it's much more the people that you're tuning in to watch, more so than seeing, you know, two guys.
The team that represents your city.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. The IFL, I think, was a perfect example of something failed like that. And you break down the concepts of what's working with mixed martial arts. You have, you know, the personalities that have been developed on The Ultimate Fighter, have been developed on shows. They're fighting for titles that mean something. People know all the champions. They know that a title fight is very important. Not just any guy walks off the street and gets a title shot. Mm-hmm. And it's guys only fight a few times a year. I think the context of mixed martial arts right now, that's probably the strongest thing it has going for it, as opposed to pro wrestling, which is throwing context out the window, where I'd be hard-pressed to name all of the champions within professional wrestling, where matches don't mean a whole lot that are announced, and it's just... I think it's just been really, really watered down. You don't believe in these characters, and consequently, you don't want to spend a whole lot of money on that product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there we go. Our little... plea to pro wrestling fans that aren't fans of mixed martial arts. But anyway, Wei, we will finish up here. From here on in through WrestleMania, I assume we'll be doing WrestleMania reviews, and I know it was my pick this week, and I wrote down a handful of WrestleManias that I thought would be interesting to review, taking into account people that had wrote in on Facebook. So I've written down the WrestleManias, Wei, and I wrote down seven of them, and they correspond with a number. So I'm going to have you pick a number between 1 and 7, and that will be which WrestleMania
really?
We
okay.
review.
So all right.
Pick a number between 1 and 7, and that'll be the WrestleMania we review next
Ooh.
Week.
3.
All right. Next week, we will be reviewing WrestleMania 9 from yes. Caesar's Palace, the largest toga party in history.
I love it.
So that'll be next week, everyone, as we head into WrestleMania in a couple of weeks. And Wei, what tune will take us out here?
I'd like to hear a song by the Chemical Brothers, The Salmon Dance, featuring Fatlip.
Hello, boys and girls. My name is Fatlip, and this is my friend, Sammy the Salmon.
What it do?
Today, we're going to teach you some fun facts about salmon and a brand new dance.